I am super excited to have you back for another episode of Red Receipt. It's a deep dive into the how and why of the brands we love and the creatives behind them. From blueprints to launch day, customers as community, and the detours in between. Big lessons and easy listening. Red Receipt is hosted by Antidote, the email and SMS marketing agency by people who hate boring email. Joining us here on the podcast today is Eva, founder of Mod, a modern sexual wellness company. Eva's journey spun from legislator in California to brand strategy in New York City, until she saw Mod as an antidote to an outdated industry. She's a creative, a modernist, an innovator, and a good friend of the show. We're super excited to have her here with us and hope you enjoy. Well, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. I'm super curious to learn about the brand and kind of find out more about how you launched it.
My name is Eva Goicoechea, and I'm the founder of Mod. Before I launched Mod, which is a modern sexual wellness company, I spent about 5 years. Well, it's been about 5 years that I've been working on it. But before that, I worked at Everlane. I was one of the first employees there. And before that, I had a long career in marketing. But my early years, in my early 20s, I was a legislative aide in healthcare. So I've had like two lives. And those two things put together became Mod, really.
How did you transition from, what was it your first career was?
I was a legislative aide in healthcare.
So how did the
California Medical Association.
How did you jump from that into marketing?
So I actually came to New York for the first time. I'm based in New York now, but I came to New York for the first time to go to college to study advertising. And 2 years into it, I decided that I wanted to do something else. And I moved back to Sacramento, where I grew up half my life, and thought I would stay for the summer. And then I ended up staying 5 years. And if you know, Sacramento is the capital. So I got this job. And I wasn't a legislative aide at first. I just got this job in this office. And then that kind of turned into me staying there for half a decade. And I loved politics. I thought that I was going to get my master's in public health and I was going to go that route. But I didn't want to be in Sacramento. So I took a job in LA and then I actually went back into marketing. It was a weird detour, but it was a formative time. And I think it laid the groundwork for doing what I do now.
And you said that you, for a time, worked at Everlane. What were you specifically working on while you were there?
When I started there, there were only three of us in the LA office. I think I was number seven in total. And I was running social media. And then about a year in, no one was paying attention to hiring or the culture. I started planning like the retreats. So suddenly I became the head of culture and hiring and still ran social media. So I did a lot of things. And we were still a small team when I left. We were only 25 when I left, but it was a funny time to be there.
Do you feel like that kind of informed how you work or how you ended up launching Mod? And is it pronounced Mod, by the way?
Yeah, it's pronounced Mod. It totally informed how I launched Mod. I think being at a company like that so early makes you understand how many hats everybody needs to wear and where you need to prioritize if you're going to have an online business. And so it was almost like school. It felt like business school in some ways. It was like an internship meets job. And I think it really helped me understand what it takes. And then that fast growth, our growth hasn't been as fast in terms of the number of people, but in terms of how much we've changed, I think that growth prepared me for what it looks like to launch a business.
Yeah, Everlane grew massively in the beginning and obviously still is. What do you think was like a few of the lessons that you learned directly from just being involved?
I mean, I think the reason that I was happy there to begin with was that they had such a clear brand. And at the time that I was there, it was still their era of basics for under $100. And so I was there when they found that radical transparency was going to be really what their mission was. And so that was an interesting time. And then I think what I really learned was how to continually evolve a brand while staying consistent, which I think is something that's overlooked for people. Like, that consistency actually from the outside, and also as someone who was there, is really what's made them successful, in my opinion. You know, that first year they didn't really know what they were, and there was that evolution, but once they found that footing, they took off.
It's funny that you say that, because I've been thinking about that recently. I feel like nobody talks about evolving brands while keeping them generally the same, and the challenge that's that kind of involves. I think that's like one of the hardest aspects of brand building, in my opinion, is like not getting too stuck on things, but also linking everything together while you're evolving the brand.
Well, and I think there changes, of course, when you're on the inside, you become impatient and you want things to, I think you want things to evolve, and you want to sort of hit these, you know, you want to hit your stride, but those changes should be incremental, because the customer needs to know what to expect. And your job as a brand, or your job as a company, or your job as a human being who's working in the world, is to be memorable or top of mind, or to make a difference in people's lives, right? So this idea of consistency, so that people know what to expect and what they can count on you for, is really important. And I think that's what Everlane has tried to do. Obviously, they've had a few issues in the past couple months, but that's neither here nor there.
And how did you come up with what was the original idea behind Mod? Or how did you come up with the idea?
So actually, this is funny. When I left Everlane, they were closing their LA office, and I didn't want to leave. I didn't want to move up to the Bay Area. And I met this duo, and they are designers. They're really fantastic. And we started working together on an idea for a watch company. I didn't go work for another company because I really wasn't set on where I wanted to be. I think Everlane was such lightning in a bottle that it was very hard to replace that experience. And so I kind of started taking on clients and working with people. So I worked with these designers. We created a small watch company, and we were having a conversation one day, and they were like, why are sexual wellness products not better designed? Why hasn't that industry changed? And it was truly a light bulb moment for me, where I was like, wait a second, these are all of the things that I care about. Making a cultural difference, making an impact in education, affecting people's health and their lives in that way was actually what I wanted to be doing. And I'm like, wait a second, what is the answer to that question? And I went full in, and they didn't want to tell their grandmas that they had a condom company, but I I was like, this is what I've been waiting for. I'm going to do this. And so that's how it really started. And it has changed. It's taken on many, many different forms since it started, but I've been working on it since 2015.
And so originally, once you came up with the idea and had like the realization that there was space in the market for something new, did you go out and kind of pitch people to raise money, or how did you originally launch it?
Yeah, so from 2015 until 2016, I worked on it from a perspective of like just doing the research. And then I didn't think it would happen. Like, it seemed like a very big endeavor. In 2016, we moved to New York, my husband and I, and I started looking for capital. I've had two other co-founders. Both are not with the company anymore, but one of them, she accidentally got pregnant, so she ended up departing the company. But she was the person that was like, okay, this is who I know in New York. I think we can start going around and pitching. She left before we got a check-in, and so I took, you know, it was really me just like out there raising. But one check-in led to another check-in, and then we put together $500,000. It took about 6 months, and then we were able to put in our first orders. But it would not have gotten off the ground if we didn't get that much money in, because it's actually, any product company just requires a lot of capital, and nobody nobody's family member was going to write a check for 100,000 condoms.
So yeah.
And we needed the cash.
What products did you originally launch with?
So the thesis behind the company is to destigmatize sexual wellness as a whole. And that includes sex toys, which we don't even refer to the Vibe as a sex toy. But so we launched with four products. The idea was have condoms, two lubricants, and a Vibe in one place and really position them as your basics. And there was a lot of debate, especially actually with investors. There was a lot of debate around, you need one hero product. You should just start a condom company. And I'm like, here are all of the reasons why that's not going to work. You really have to position these products together, because the idea is not that you're necessarily making one hero product. It's that you're destigmatizing the whole industry. So anyway, we launched with four.
And what type of investors did you end up raising money from? Were they like individual investors, or was it VCs?
Yeah, I mean, it was a lot of angels. And then we ended up having a couple of checks in from VCs. And the one that led the round, I cold emailed. It was a very large fund that had a smaller fund specifically for women. And I sent them an email, forgot about it, and then received an email back at some point. And so that ended up being the team that led the round. But now we're three rounds in. I'm in the middle of a third round, and we have many funds involved.
And when you launched, was your vision to have the brand be direct to consumer only, or were you doing wholesale as well?
No, it wasn't to be direct to consumer. I've never been of the philosophy that like you can, you know, to use this typical word, that you can like truly disrupt a market online, especially when it comes to consumer products. People still buy these products in the store. So I always knew we needed to be omni-channel, but we launch, you know, you can't go from zero to 100. It's not like you can launch in Target when you first start the company. Maybe some people have, but they had Target connections. So we started going into a few hotels. There was a lot of brand sort of synergy with hotels, because the products themselves live in hotels anyway. And then we had a couple of retailers pick us up, but primarily the brand, and still is 2 years in, is about 90% direct to consumer. And at some point we'll go more omni-channel, but it's just a real graduation of how, you know, it's a lot of product to be able to really launch in mass.
And you said, so before you actually ended up raising money, did you work on the actual brand identity before that?
Yeah. I know I'm a long-winded talker, so I'll try to make all of this short, but I think when we first, I have been a designer for a long time. And so the first thing we did when we came up with the idea for Mon in 2015 was put a website up, and it had a brand identity, which was from the two designers that I worked with. Then we went and had a second brand identity done and started to get closer to like what the real heart of the company was. And then we did a third one. So the third one is what exists now, but we got the graphic elements and the logo from one designer, and then I built the brand book. And so we now have a 95-page brand manual that I built. We're only a 5-person team. But to talk about brand consistency and knowing who you are, that this is like the Bible. So, and that's what really helped us raise money. It was like, look, I can tell you that this brand is really strong, and it's going to create the equity and affinity that you need to get, you know, to do anything in this category.
And what do you feel like the most important aspects of the brand consistency are in terms of gaining trust from customers in this space?
I think, you know, great product is, I always say, like table stakes. It's their experience. It's making sure that they're spoken to in a way that feels real, and also creating a brand that feels inclusive. I mean, the word inclusivity gets thrown around a lot these days, but I think for us, it's actually about, we say behind the scenes, we're gender and age agnostic, because sex is such a human thing. And so our customers expect that that's what we pay attention to. Like, we don't talk to them like they are of one gender. We try to make sure that our content is pretty broad. That's the most important thing for us, is making sure that they feel like Mod is theirs, not ours, if that makes any sense.
And how do you feel like you cultivate that, like, on a day-to-day basis internally? Just the feeling of it being theirs. Sorry.
Yeah, I think it's, I think it's more the tone that we take with them, not talking at them. And also, it's the overall, I would say, the overall content, whether that is in the language or in the visuals, or in the actual content. We have a blog, but I think it's just really being, always looking at it through a human lens, not thinking about it from one particular person's perspective. It's always like, could I read this as a 45-year-old male and care? And we don't always hit the mark. It's hard to do everything, but I think we try to make sure that what we're saying is evergreen and relevant to most people.
And knowing your background, I mean, you worked kind of in the brand space before, obviously in a much different product category. How did you go about actually developing the product and working on the product? Was that before you went out to raise money or after?
So in 2015, we knew what we wanted the product to be. Well before I had the two co-founders, we knew what the old renderings are basically what we ended up with, just in terms of like the bag and the bottle. A lot of the product was, the idea was to make things easier to use. So that's where the pump top came from, this idea of having a bag, buttercup condoms. And then I saw the shape for the vibe. I saw a similar shape out in the world, and I came back and was like, this is what I want it to be. And my husband happens to be a mechanical engineer, and he was able to AutoCAD it and turn it back around to me. And that, we didn't go through multiple shapes, actually. It ended up being amazing. So it started from day one with thinking about product, and then that's what we ended up with, which sounds funny, but it was like we knew that was first.
No, I mean, in a certain way, it sounds like the product came together so organically that you weren't in a position where you were just trying to force things to work for what you wanted.
No, I mean, I think that actually I'm missing a big piece of this story, which is that somewhere along the way, I did a really big survey, and that survey validated everything that I thought, which is like the product should be easier to use. We shouldn't have too many SKUs. We should make sure that it's at this price point. And so that, getting that validation for anybody listening that's building a company, like having the outside validation before you ever take anything to, I would say even to prototyping, is important, because it sounds good to you and then you put it out in the world and nobody wants it. That's not what you want. So that was the first thing.
And so now, after getting the product developed and raising some seed capital to put the first initial order in, what was the overall strategy and idea for how you were going to get the brand out into the world and create a community?
It's pretty funny, because when that landing page went up in 2015 with that really old branding, we actually got a phone call from a magazine that wanted to post about it, which was interesting. So we knew early on that there was traction around this particular industry, since it had been ignored for so long. So a year before we launched the company with the actual branding that we went to market with, we put up a landing page. We did another survey. We had people sign up to get product. They would be the first ones to receive a sample of the product. And then we got a ton of press around it. And so there was like a whole year before launch that we were building community. There was a social following. Our first hire, who ended up coming aboard full time and is still with the company, was our social media person. So I think, like, you don't want to like launch it and have no one pay attention. I think like working on it really early and making sure that you're building relationships with writers and getting it out there is really important. So, I mean, that took us like a year. It was a long time.
And you guys have like you have a very specific look in terms of content and obviously branding. How do you guys approach creating the content and keeping that consistent, especially now with the changes in how everyone's living and working?
Well, so that was interesting. So kind of like the Everlane story of like evolving what you stand for. I think our original tagline was sex made simple. And I think that spoke to the products, but it didn't really speak to the ethos of the company or like what we really more broadly were standing for. And what we really stand for is modern intimacy, whatever that looks like to you. So that became our tagline later. And that actually was a good segue into creating content for when people are stuck at home, because modern intimacy at the moment means something different than when you're running around. And it was easy for us to transition that content to talking about being at home and whether it's communication or making time for intimacy, or just like we've done a feature now twice a week where we highlight what people's intimate lives look like. And we're not talking about sex. We're actually just talking about like it could be that they play checkers together. It doesn't really matter. So the content itself like evolved pretty naturally into this. And then we also took, this is an interesting, it was interesting. We took this pop-up that we had last summer with 24 other brands, and we put it online, and now it's over 30 brands, and we basically took all of their content, aggregated it together. And so there's like this one stop. It's not our existing blog. It's actually all of their content mushed together. And that's called Staycation. And so we found easy ways to take content and turn it into something that's relevant for now.
I feel like that's a good segue into like outside of how you've changed the overall kind of like tone or voice of the brand to be relevant in the times of COVID and the pandemic, how else have you kind of had to change the way that you guys are working in general or approaching the marketing and the brand?
So it actually has been great for us because it means that people pay attention to their intimate lives. You know, before we were competing with, there was this assumption like we're not going to be able to really talk to people from 9 a.m. to 6 p.m. because they're at work and they're not going on mod. And now there's so much more interaction and people are paying attention. Like we've fared really, really well in all of this. We were able to stay open for a number of reasons. We actually fulfill, we have a warehouse next to our office. We fulfill out of it. So we're able to stay open in general. But people are also buying these products. They're stuck at home. What else are they doing? So I don't know. It's been an interesting time because I'm watching other companies become irrelevant, but I'm like, this is like people have nothing else to talk about but this. So
it's so interesting.
Yeah.
It is so interesting because I never even thought about the fact that you guys run an e-commerce store and like thinking that most people are probably not going to go shopping. Even if they do go on the internet and like browse around at work, they're probably not shopping for the types of products that you sell during the day.
No, they're totally not shopping for our products during the day. And, you know, that's made up for by the fact that we are in four time zones because we ship to more than that because we ship to Hawaii too. But it's a really interesting dynamic and it's definitely changed and it's picked up a ton. For instance, our vibrator, we sold out of our vibrator because of Valentine's Day. And then we had supply chain delays with everything that's happened. But we've actually sold 2,000 units on pre-order. And people are like, where's my vibrator? So navigating this has been really interesting and the content has been fun to make, but...
Have you guys doubled down on the content? Like, how has the situation changed the way that you communicate about the brand?
We used to do maybe two posts a week. We do five or more. So that's just on our own site. And then we have Staycation. So we're managing 30 people's content. So the content piece has just blown up. And I think for us, it's like... The content itself was always, it was always part of the brand. The idea was like, can you be the place in which you talk about sex from a cultural, you know, sort of historical, scientific, design, et cetera, from that angle. And it was always there anyway. And now it's just bubbled up. Like we are like seeing more and more, I think, conversations around like how sex affects every part of your life. And then it makes sense for us to continue to just ramp up content. So it's really fun.
Yeah, it seems.
We'll see what happens when everyone goes back to work.
Yeah. I mean, what are your general feelings for how things are going to unfold in the future? I mean, in general, I think people probably won't work the same way that they did even for some time. So the way you guys communicate to your audience seems like it's even more relevant moving forward.
Yeah. And I think it comes down to, like, if we had just talked about sex, if we were a hyper explicit brand, I think we would be, I don't know that we would see the same feedback or the same engagement. I think having a broader lens around what does intimacy mean is, yeah, I think the conversation cracked open with everything now and with people stuck at home with their significant others, or frankly, like stuck at home alone, you know, how they're dating, how they're faring being alone. What does that look like in terms of feeling, you know, there's all of these other things happening and we didn't start these conversations. We just happened to be there at the time in which people are having them more and more. So after this, I think that people will have navigated this time with the different perspective on like what their relationships or lack thereof looks like. I'm very curious to see what that means.
And talking about the kind of like the traction that you guys have seen, how have you guys gone about, and how did you go about it in the beginning, acquiring new customers and finding an audience that became your kind of loyal customer base?
So the first thing was press, like I said. That was a big one. And we ended up, when we launched the day that we launched, the piece that launched was in Vogue. And Vogue kind of became the domino effect for all these other pieces. So for us, it was press. And the second thing was social. And so building out organic community and engaging with people online and posting on a regular basis, it was really those two things. And they're both related to just having relationships. And we went full in. Even now we manage our own press. We've worked with a couple of people along the way, at times that are really busy, but for the most part, we really put those relationships first and social is a huge part of our business. And so that's what I recommend. I think you have to build community in an organic way because that drives the longevity of the business. You can't depend on paid advertising to do anything for the long term. So we're trying to build a solvent business.
And you guys, since launching, how many products, like how often do you guys launch new products?
We have launched, well, we launched our four products in April when we first launched, which is 2018, and then launched a product in the fall. And then we launched Travel Size the following summer, and then we launched more product in the fall. And so we'll probably launch every 3 to 6 months. We're not on a regular cadence, and there's a lot of reasons for that. I think we're not overcapitalized. We've raised 3 rounds of funding, but they haven't been huge. And so just making sure that we can navigate how we build product and release it is interesting. And then there's a lot to talk about. We don't want to create 50 products at a time. To go back to Everlane for a second, it was really interesting to see them go from, you don't need a lot of stuff, you just need these 10 things, to now they release a product a week or more. It's very, it's a lot. I can't imagine having a company that releases that much product.
Yeah, I think the reason why I asked and I'm interested is because I think a lot of people launch brands and then they either feel like they have to launch product consistently in order to have things to talk about, or on the other spectrum, companies that have a few SKUs find it somewhat challenging to keep people engaged over time, only having that same set of product. And I think you guys are somewhat unique in the fact that you don't have a huge product range, but you are launching things throughout the year, and also finding different ways to have conversations that keep people coming back and engaged with the brand?
Well, one of the interesting things that is sort of two sides of the same coin. On one hand, we don't see our customers come back every month. They're not having that much sex, and they come back 3, 6, 12 months. So from that perspective, you ask yourself, like, have I done my job with the customers that we have in terms of educating them around the product? And do we create enough newness, or is there enough takeaway in our content that keeps them around? And then on the other side, it's, you know, if you know that this is something, and I don't know, it's very interesting to be in this space in particular, because it's like sex affects every adult. So I'm always thinking, well, there's always new customers to acquire. Why would I need to keep releasing this like new product to the same customers when there are always new products to, you know, new customers to reach? And so that's what we think about, is like doing right by our existing customers and finding customers that we resonate with every single day. That's how we, you know, it's two tracks that we're trying to run. But
and I ask this for somewhat personal reasons also, but I'm curious, like, so you said you guys manage your own press.
Yeah.
And you're, and talking about the fact that you don't launch products on a typical cadence, like, how have you approached gaining press coverage consistently in order to acquire those new customers that are, that could be interested in purchasing from you? What are some of the techniques or strategies that you've used to gain press consistently?
So a big one is affiliate. And affiliate for us, actually, we haven't even scratched the surface of what affiliate could be. And it drives actually a big portion of our business. And what we found was, you know, there's somewhat of a novelty to this type of product. So I think people do want to write about it. And there's not that, you know, there's not that big of an assortment of brands in this space. So that's one thing to note. You can't like turn around and start a skincare company and think that you're going to get a ton of press. It's very hard. It's like a very saturated market. But building those relationships with affiliate managers and affiliate networks, and making sure that they know that you're releasing something, or trying to get them to write about something by being, you know, basically writing it for them on and in a timely way, is really how you do it. It's like, Bob needs to write about stuff during Valentine's Day. Like, let's just reach out to him and make sure he knows we exist. So it's a lot of strategy, but it's also pretty common sense in terms of how you think about when people need to hear about your particular product. And right now, obviously, like, publishing companies and content sites are having a hard time. So if they can make money off of you, like, they're happy to do it.
And what's kind of your view on, or what's your vision for the brand in terms of where you guys want to take things, both from a conversation standpoint and then also product in the future?
So, I mean, I always envision this company being the next chapter in sexual wellness. Right now, there are the three big companies. There's really in the US, there's like Durex, Lifestyles, and Trojan being the biggest. And my goal is for Maud to be a household name. And I want that because it's needed. I think when you look at the feedback that people have had around this space, it's, you know, people over 25 don't feel spoken to. It's been misogynistic for a long time. The product is confusing and outdated. So it's really needed. And my hope is that Maud does that. It's like the Method soap. I want it to be the Method soap for your sex life.
It is such a weird thought that the brands that are massive in the US speak to an age demographic that's so young.
And the thing is, like, those people, like, 22-year-olds are smarter than that. In 2020, 22-year-olds are not, they're not buying, like, they buy Trojan because they need condoms, but they're not like, you know, I really love that brand. So that's one. I really do want us to make a difference. And I think that, like I said earlier, it has to do with how much impact that has on not only individuals and how they feel about themselves and their relationships, but there is so much work to be done on sex education in the US. And if we can play a small part in destigmatizing and normalizing conversations around sex enough for that to happen, then I would, you know, die happy. And I think we're just beginning. We're not, you know, we haven't even started really. So that's what I want for the company. And I think the reason that we think about sex more broadly is because it is broader than just having sex. It's everything in your life in terms of your interpersonal relationships with other people romantically. It's, you know, it relates to a lot of things. So that's why the content piece, the evolution of the content piece, and then thinking about products for before, during, and after sex are really important to us. But, you know, there has to be some sexiness.
It's also fascinating because I feel like a lot of brands right now are kind of altering their positioning based on what's going on in the world currently. But it sounds like you guys are more just like staying the course and doubling down in terms of talking to people that are at home now and probably more in the mind state that they're willing and able to interact with a brand like yours. How is your team structured internally? Just out of curiosity.
So we're actually only 5 people. We have a director of product who also runs wholesale and supply chain. We have a ops and warehouse manager who basically handles that team of part-time people. And then we have someone who runs content and partnerships, and then somebody who runs social media and press and affiliate. So we all wear a lot of hats. We're super tiny. And then obviously, like, we have our director of finance works for, you know, it's outsourced. We have a director of marketing who's outsourced, and then we have our lawyers, and our tax accountants. But I think it's, for the most part, our core team is primarily focused on product and marketing, and it works really well. I mean, we're all tired. I don't even know if I'm making sense right now, but I think having a really capital efficient business and a small team, especially now, I feel lucky about that because we didn't have any staff changes through COVID. We've been able to kind of stick the course. Yeah.
It is interesting too, because I didn't even think about the fact that people buy those types of products every once in a while. It's not something that you are like interacting with as often as things that are repeat purchase heavy businesses. So it sounds like, I don't know, from the outside, it sounds like you have a very, organic way of growing the business, even though, you also have obviously raised money and have investors who want to see a successful outcome. How have you balanced the expectations of the business with, the patience that it sounds like you have for growing it in the right way?
Well, we have, because we're in sexual wellness and there are so many restrictions on advertising, and it's also a hard industry to raise in. I mean, there's a lot of investors who don't want to invest in sexual wellness. They understand why we exist. They think it's a space that needs to change, but, you know, there's still a lot of conservative deep pockets. And I think that because of those things, we've navigated growth in ways that are sustainable and have, you know, allowed for me to be really realistic. And so the investors that believe in us are here because they, you know, they truly do believe in the business and understand the challenges that we're going to face. And so I feel kind of lucky. On the days when we got told no, it didn't make me feel defeated. It made me feel like, okay, there's a lot of work to be done still. And that's a good thing. So I would just say our growth has matched. We've outperformed what we ever thought we could do in 2 years. But I think all along the way, we faced enough challenge that there's been a real conversation that's very honest with our investors and the team. And we've had challenges internally too. It's never easy. You think you can plan everything when you start a business, and shit goes wrong. It's just inevitable. So,
what? I'm like curious to hear specifics, but what do you think one of the biggest lessons that you've learned since launching the brand, or is there something that you wish you could have told yourself when you were embarking on launching the brand, now knowing everything that's unfolded since?
Yeah, I mean, there were a lot of instances along the way where someone else told me what MOD was. And I think when you're really a first-time entrepreneur, even though I've built other businesses and I'm not I always say I'm not a spring chicken, but like I let other people tell me what it was, and I always knew what it was. I didn't need them to tell me. So one, it's listening to everybody else. You really should trust yourself. I think too, that also means in some ways, like I had co-founders who I didn't really think I needed, but I convinced myself I did. So if you're going to have a co-founder, like be very certain that you need that. That's all I'll say on that topic. And then I think just making sure that you are in it for reasons that are real. Because it's not, for as many presses as we've had or as many podcasts that I've been on, like it is so much work and it is really, really a roller coaster. And you have to want to get up every day and fight it. And so I think that's really what it is like. I don't know. I could tell you specifics of silly mistakes I've made, but like, I think everyone has to go through them. You can't tell everybody what to anticipate. I think people do need to make mistakes to build something.
And is there anything that you guys have coming up later this year? I know a lot of plans have now changed with the whole pandemic, but is there anything you guys have coming up that you're excited about or that you're working on launching?
Yeah, so we have more products coming up this year. We are in May, we're going to relaunch the content side of the site and it's going to be much bigger. And then there's a couple of exciting things in the works that I can't talk about, but hopefully I can tell you about soon.
And is the content side of the site, is that more of the education side of the brand?
It's more of the education side of the brand, but it's also broadening the, like who we're talking to. Our audience, our demographic is primarily 25 to 45, but we do have customers who are younger and older than that. And so the content will start to bring that to life in a more visible way. Bread receipt.